This is podcast number 153 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I have the true story of Evangeline for you. In the last podcast, I mentioned that Longfellow once said that Evangeline was his favorite poem that he wrote. Today I want to share the true story of Evangeline as told by her adopted mother. In the telling of the story, you're going to learn about the Acadians, a group of French families who settled in Acadia, which is present-day Nova Scotia and other nearby areas in Canada, as well as parts of Maine. When the British scattered them, many of them relocated to Louisiana, where the Acadians became known as the Cajuns. If you happen to like Cajun cooking, that's where the name came from these French Acadians. There are a lot of lessons woven into this story. Let's get started. My native land is called Acadia. It is a cold and desolate region during winter, and snow covers the ground during several months of the year. It is rocky and huge, and rugged stones lie strewn over the surface of the ground in many places, and one must struggle hard for a livelihood there, especially with the poor and meager tools possessed by my people. My country is not like yours, diversified by rolling and gentle hills, covered the year round with a thick carpet of green grass, and where every plant sprouts up and grows to maturity as if by magic, and where one may enrich himself easily, provided he fears God and is laborious and economical. Yet I grieve for my native land, with its rocks and snows, because I have left there a part of my heart, in the graves of those I love so well, and who sleep under its sod. And as she spoke thus, her eyes streamed with tears and emotion choked her utterance. You must know that less than 100 years ago, Acadia was a French province whose people lived contented and happy. The King of France sent brave officers to govern the province, and these officers treated us with the greatest kindness. Although poor, they were honest and industrious, and they lived contented with what little they had, without envying their neighbors, and how could it be otherwise? If anyone was unable to do his field work because of illness or of some other misfortune, his neighbors flew to his assistance, and it required but a few days' work with their combined efforts to weed his field and save his crop. Thus it was that, incited by noble and generous feeling, the inhabitants of the province seemed to form one single family and not a community composed of separate families. We lacked none of the comforts of life, and although not wealthy, we were not in want, as our wishes were few and easily satisfied. Plainness and simplicity of manners are the mainsprings of happiness, and he that wishes for what he may never have or acquire must be miserable indeed and worthy of pity. Alas, the Acadians are losing by degrees the remembrance of the traditions and customs of the mother country. The love of gold has implanted itself in their hearts, and this will bring no happiness to them. In Acadia, early marriages were highly favored. No obstacle was thrown in the way of a loving couple who desired to marry. The lover accepted by the maiden obtained the ready consent of the parents, and no one dreamed of inquiring whether the lover was a man of means or whether the destined bride brought a handsome dowry, as we are wont to do nowadays. Their mutual choice proved satisfactory to all. As soon as the marriage of a young couple was determined, the men of the village, after having built a cozy little home for them, cleared and planted the land parceled out to them. And while they so generously extended their aid and assistance, the women were not laggards in their kindness to the bride. To her they made presents of what they deemed most necessary for the comfort and utility of her household, and all this was done and given with honest and willing hearts. Everything was orderly and neat in the home of the happy couple, and after the marriage ceremony in the church and the wedding feast at the home of the bride's father, the happy couple were escorted to their new home by the young men and the young maidens of the village. How genial was the joy that warmed our hearts and brightened our souls on these occasions! How noisy and light the gaiety of the young people! how unalloyed their merriment and happiness. I will now relate to you what befell them, and how a cruel war sowed ruin and desolation in their homes. It was on a Sunday. I remember this as if it were but yesterday. We were attending Mass, and when our old curate ascended his pulpit, as he was wont to do every Sunday, he announced to us that war was being waged between France and England. "My children," said he in sad and solemn tones, "you may expect to witness awful scenes and to undergo sore trials, but God will not forsake you if you will put your trust in His infinite mercy." And then, kneeling down, he prayed aloud for France, and we all responded to his fervent voice and said Amen from the depths of our hearts. A painful silence prevailed in the little church until Mass was over. As we left the church, the people grouped themselves on all sides to discuss the sad news, and then we retired mournfully and quietly to our homes. This intelligence troubled us, and we tried in vain to shake off the gloom that darkened our souls. England had enlisted hundreds of Indians in her armies, and we knew the bloodthirsty savages spared no one and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on their prisoners. Then we argued ourselves into a different mood by thinking that this news might, after all, be exaggerated and that perhaps our apprehensions were unfounded. Why should England wage war upon us? Acadia, so poor, so desolate, so sparsely peopled, was surely not worth the shedding of a single drop of blood for its conquest. The storm would pass by without even ruffling our peace and tranquility. We argued thus to rid ourselves of the gloomy forebodings that troubled us, but despite our endeavors, our fears haunted us and made us despondent and miserable. The news that reached us now and then were far from being encouraging. France, whelmed in defeat, seemed to have abandoned us. The English were gaining ground, and our Canadian brothers were calling for our assistance. 6 months passed away without our receiving the least intelligence. We knew, however, that the war was still progressing and that the French were losing ground every day. The English directed all their efforts against Canada and seemed to have lost sight of Acadia in the turmoil and fury of battle. In spite of our anxiety and apprehensions, the peace and quiet of the colony remained unruffled. Alas, we had been lulled to security by deceitful hopes, and the storm that had swept along Canada was about to burst upon us with unchecked fury. Our day of trial had dawned, and, doomed victims of a cruel fate, we were about to undergo sufferings beyond human endurance and to experience unparalleled outrages and cruelties. One morning at a dawn of day, a young man was lying unconscious on the green near the church. His arm was shattered and he had bled profusely. It was with the greatest difficulty that we restored him to life. When he opened his eyes, his looks were wild and terrified, and despite his weakness, he made a desperate effort to rise and flee. We quieted him with friendly words, and when he had recovered from the exhaustion occasioned by the loss of blood, he related to us what had happened to him, and we listened to his words with breathless suspense and anxiety. "The English," said he, "have landed troops on the eastern coast of Acadia, and are committing the most atrocious cruelties. Their inhumanity surpasses belief. They pillage and burn our villages, and even lay sacrilegious hands on the sacred vessels in our churches. They tear the wives from their husbands, the children from their parents, and they drive their ill-fated victims to the seashore and stow them on ships which sail immediately for unknown lands. They spare only such as become traitors to their faith and to their king. They raided our village at dusk yesterday. They reduced it to ashes. They have driven its inhabitants to the seashore like cattle, and when through sheer exhaustion one of their victims fell by the roadside, I have seen the fiends compel him with the butts of their muskets to rise and walk. I have escaped in the darkness of night, with an arm shattered by a random shot, and I have run exhausted by the loss of blood. I fell where you have found me. They will overrun Acadia, and they will not spare you, my friends, if you show any hostility to them. Your town will be raided shortly, and you cannot resist them, my friends. Abandon your homes and seek safety elsewhere while you have the time and chance to do so. You may well imagine that our trouble was great when we heard this terrible news. We stood there not knowing what to do. In our predicament and in so critical an emergency, our only alternative was to apply to our old curate for advice. He gave us words of encouragement and withdrew with our elders to his room. At last, our elders, accompanied by our old curate, sallied out of that house with sorrowful countenances, but with steady step and firm resolve written on their brow. Their countenance bespoke the gravity of the situation, far more serious, indeed, than we then realized, and as they approached us in the deathlike silence that prevailed, we could distinctly hear the throbbings of our hearts. "My good friend," said he, "our hopes were illusory, and the future is big with ominous threats for us. A cruel and relentless enemy is at our doors. The story of the wounded man is true. The English are applying the torch to our villages and are spreading and scattering ruin as they advance. They spare neither old age nor infirmity, neither women nor children, and are tender-hearted only to renegades and apostates. Are you ready to accept these humiliating conditions and to be branded as traitors and cowards?" "Never," we answered, "never." "Then let exile be our lot. Let us prepare for the worst, for today we bid adieu forever, perhaps to Acadia, to our homes, to the graves of those we love so well. We leave friendless and penniless for distant lands." Ah, it was a cruel day to us. We were leaving Acadia. We were abandoning the homes where our children were born and raised. Everything that we saw, every object that we touched, recalled to our hearts some sweet remembrance of days gone by. And we were leaving them forever. As we gazed upon them, we wept bitterly. And submitting to the will of God, we preferred our exile and poverty before dishonoring ourselves by becoming traitors and renegades. Our people, so meek, so peaceable, became frenzied with despair. The women and children wandered from house to house, wailing and uttering piercing cries. Every object of spoil was destroyed, and the torch was applied to the houses. The fire, famed by a too willing breeze, spread rapidly, and in a moment's time, St. Gabriel was wrapped in a lurid sheet of devouring flames. We could hear the cracking of planks tortured by the blaze, the crash of falling roofs, while the flame shot up to an immense height with the hissing and soughing of a hurricane. It was a fair image of pandemonium. The people seemed an army of fiends, spreading ruin and desolation in their path. The work oxen were killed and a few among us, with the hope of a speedy return to Acadia, threw our silverware into the wells. Oh, the ruin, it was horrible. We left St. Gabriel numbering about 300, whilst the ashes of our burning houses, carried by the wind, whirled past us like a pillar of light to guide our faltering steps through the wilderness that stretched before us. As darkness came, we cast a sad look toward the spot where our peaceful and happy St. Gabriel once stood. Alas, we could see nothing but the crimson sky reflecting the lurid glare of the flames that devoured our Acadian villages. Not a word fell from our lips as we journeyed slowly on, and as night came, its darkness increased our misery, and such was our dejection that we would have faced death without a shudder. At last, we halted in a deep ravine, shadowed by projecting rocks, and we sat down to rest our weary limbs. We built no fires and spoke only in whispers, fearing that the blazing fire, that the least sound might betray us in our place of concealment. With hearts failing, compressed with gloomy forebodings, the events of the day seemed to us a frightful dream. Oh, that it had only been a dream! Our elders had withdrawn a few paces away from us, to decide on the best course to pursue, for in the hurry of our departure, no plan of action had been decided upon, our main object being to escape the outrages and ill treatment of a merciless and cruel soldiery. It was decided to reach Canada the best way we could, after which, after crossing the Great Northern Lakes, our journey was to be overland to the Mississippi River, on whose waters we would float down to Louisiana, a French colony inhabited by people of our own race, and professing the same religious creed as ours. But to carry out this plan, we had to travel thousands of miles through a country barren of civilization, through endless forests, and across lakes as wide and deep as the sea. We were to overcome obstacles without number and to encounter dangers and hardships at every step, and yet we remained firm in our resolve. We submitted to our fate, sacrificing our all in this world for our religion and for the love of France. We knelt down to implore the aid and protection of God in the many dangers that beset us, and, trusting in His kind providence, we lay down on the bare ground to sleep. When the moon rose, dispelling by degrees the darkness of night, we again pursued our journey. We made the least noise possible as we advanced cautiously, our fears and apprehensions increasing at every step. All at once our column halted. A death-like silence prevailed. We had not advanced 200 yards when we were halted by a company of English soldiers. Our doom was sealed. We were in a narrow path surrounded by the enemy, without the possibility of escape. How shall I describe what followed? The women wrung their hands and sobbed piteously in their despair. The children, terrified, uttered shrill and piercing cries, while the men, goaded to madness, vented their rage in hurried exclamations, and were determined to sell their lives as dearly as possible. The officer in command approached us. "Acadians," said he, "you have fled from your homes after having reduced them to ashes. You have used seditious language against England, and we find you here in the depth of night, congregated and conspiring against the king. You are traitors, and you should be treated as such. But in his clemency, the king offers his pardon to all who will swear fealty and allegiance to him." "Sir," answered Rene Leblanc, under whose guidance we had left St. Gabriel, "our king is the king of France, and we are not traitors to the king of England, whose subjects we are not. It is by the force of arms you have conquered this country. We are willing to recognize your supremacy, but we are not willing to submit to English rule, and for that reason we have abandoned our homes to emigrate to Louisiana, to seek there, under the protection of the French flag, the quiet and peace and happiness we have enjoyed here." The officer, who had listened with folded arms to the noble words of Rene Leblanc, replied with a scowl of hatred, "To Louisiana you wish to go? To Louisiana you shall go, and seek in vain under the French flag that protection you have failed to receive from it in Canada. Soldiers," he added, with a smile that made us shudder, "escort these worthy patriots to the seashore, where transportation will be given them free in His Majesty's ships." These words sounded like a death knell to us. They treated us most brutally and had no regard either for age or for sex. They drove us back through the forest to the seashore, where their ships were anchored, and stowing the greater number of our party in one of their ships, they weighed anchor and she set sail. The balance of our people had been embarked on another vessel, which had departed in advance of ours. Is it necessary that I should speak to you of our despair when thus torn from our relatives and friends? Is it necessary that I should describe the horror of our plight, our sufferings, our mental anguish during the many days that our voyage on the sea lasted? We were huddled in a space scarcely large enough to contain us. We could not lie down to rest our weary limbs. With but scant food, with the water given grudgingly to us, barely enough to wet our parched lips, with no one to care for us, you can well imagine that our sufferings became unbearable. At last our ship was anchored, and we were told that we had reached the place of our destination. Was it Louisiana? We inquired. Rude scoffs and sharp invectives were their only answer. We were disembarked with the same ruthless brutality with which we had been dragged to their ship. They landed us on a precipitous and rocky shore, and leaving us a few rations, saluted us in derision with their caps and bidding farewell to the noble patriots, as they called us. Our anguish at that moment can hardly be conceived. We were outcasts in a strange land. We were friendless and penniless, with a few rations thrown to us as to dogs. The sun had now set, and we were in an agony of despair. Our only hope rested in the mercy of a kind providence, and with hearts too full for utterance, we knelt down with one accord and silently besought the Lord of hosts to vouchsafe to us that pity and protection which he gives to the most abject of his creatures. Never was a more heartfelt prayer wafted to God's throne. When we arose, hope, once more smiling to us, irradiated our souls and dispelled, as if by magic, the gloom that had settled in our hearts. With a clear conscience, we lay down to sleep under the blue canopy of the heavens. The dawn of day found us scattered in groups, discussing the course we were to pursue, and our hearts grew faint anew at the thought of the unknown trials that awaited us. At that moment, we spied two horsemen approaching our camp. Our hearts fluttered with emotion. When the cavaliers alighted, they addressed us in English, but in words so soft and kind that the sound of the hated language did not grate on our ears and seemed as sweet as that of our own tongue. They bowed gracefully to us and introduced themselves as Charles Smith and Henry Brent. "We are informed," said they, "that you are exiles and that you have been cast penniless on our shores. We have come to greet you and to welcome you to the hospitality of our roofs." These kind words sank deep in our hearts. "Good sirs," answered Rene Leblanc, "you behold a wretched people bereft of their homes and whose only crime is their love for France and their devotion to the Catholic faith. We thank you heartily for your greeting and for your hospitality so generously tendered, but see, we number over 200 persons, and it would be taxing your generosity too heavily. No one but a king could accomplish your noble design." "Sir," they answered, "we are citizens of Maryland, and we own large estates. We have everything in abundance at our homes, and this abundance we are willing to share with you. Accept our offer, and the Brent and Smith families will ever be grateful to God, who has given them the means to minister to your wants, assuage your afflictions, and soothe your sorrows." How could we decline an offer so generously made? It was impossible for us to find words expressive of our gratitude. Unable to utter a single word, we shook hands with them, but our silence was far more eloquent than any language we could have used. The same day we moved to their farms, which lay nearby, and I shall never forget the kind welcome we received from these two families. They vied with each other in their kind offices toward us, and ministered to our wants with so much grace and affability that it gave additional charm and value to their already boundless hospitality. Let the names of Brent and of Smith remain encased forever like precious jewels in your hearts. Let their remembrance never fade from your memory, for more generous and worthier beings never breathed the pure air of heaven. Thus it was that we settled in Maryland after leaving Acadia. 3 years passed away peacefully and happily, and during the whole of that time, the Smith and Brent families remained our steadfast friends. Our party had prospered, and plenty smiled once more in our homes. We lived as happily as exiles could live away from the fatherland, ignorant of the fate of those who had been torn from us so ruthlessly. In vain we had endeavored to ascertain the lot of our friends and relatives and what had become of them. We could learn nothing. Many parents wept for their lost children. Many a disconsolate wife pined away in sorrow and hopeless grief for a lost husband. But the saddest of all was the fate of poor Emmeline Labiche. Emmeline Labiche? Who was Emmeline Labiche? Emmeline Labiche was an orphan whose parents had died when she was quite a child. I had taken her to my home and had raised her as my own daughter. How sweet-tempered, how loving she was. She had grown to womanhood with all the attractions of her sex, and although not a beauty in the sense usually given to that word, she was looked upon as the handsomest girl of St. Gabriel. Her soft, transparent hazel eyes mirrored her pure thoughts. Her dark brown hair waved in graceful undulations on her intelligent forehead and fell in ringlets on her shoulders. Her bewitching smile, her slender, symmetrical shape, all contributed to make her a most attractive picture of maiden loveliness. Emmeline, who had just completed her 16th year, was on the eve of marrying a most deserving, laborious, and well-to-do young man of St. Gabriel, Louis Arsenault. Their mutual love dated from their earliest years, and all agreed that Providence willed their union as man and wife, she the fairest young maiden, he the most deserving youth of St. Gabriel. The nuptial day was fixed, and their long love dream was about to be realized when the barbarous scattering of our colony took place. Our oppressors had driven us to the seashore, where their ships rode at anchor, when Louis, resisting, was brutally wounded by them. Emmeline had witnessed the whole scene. Her lover was carried on board on one of the ships. The anchor was weighed, and a stiff breeze soon drove the vessel out of sight. Emmeline, tearless and speechless, stood fixed to the spot, motionless as a statue, and when the white sail vanished in the distance, she uttered a wild, piercing shriek and fell fainting to the ground. When she came to, she clasped me in her arms, and in an agony of grief, she sobbed piteously. "Mother, mother," she said in broken words, "he is gone. They have killed him. What will become of me?" I soothed her grief with endearing words until she wept freely, but the sadness of her countenance betokened the sorrow that preyed on her heart. Thus she lived in our midst, always sweet-tempered, but with such sadness depicted in her countenance and with smiles so sorrowful that we had come to look upon her as not of this earth, but rather as our guardian angel, and this is why we called her no longer Emmeline, but Evangeline, or God's little angel. Emmeline had been exiled to Maryland with me. She was, as I have told you, my adopted child. She dwelt with me, and she followed me in my long pilgrimage from Maryland to Louisiana. I shall not relate to you now the many dangers that beset us on our journey, and the many obstacles we had to overcome to reach Louisiana. This would be anticipating what remains for me to tell you. When we reached the Teche country, we found there the whole population congregated to welcome us. As we went ashore, Emmeline walked by my side, but seemed not to admire the beautiful landscape that unfolded itself to our gaze. She lived in the past, and her soul was absorbed in the mournful regret of that past. She walked beside me with a measured step. All at once she grasped my hand, and as if fascinated by some vision, she stood rooted to the spot, and with silvery tones of a voice vibrating with joy, "Mother, mother," she cried out, "it is he, it is Louis," pointing to the tall figure of a man reclining under a large oak tree. That man was Louis Arsenault. With the rapidity of lightning, she flew to his side and in an ecstasy of joy. "Louis, Louis," said she, "I'm your Emmeline, your long-lost Emmeline. Have you forgotten me?" Louis turned ashy pale and hung down his head without uttering a word. "Louis," said she, painfully impressed by her lover's silence and coldness, "why do you turn away from me? I am still your Emmeline, your betrothed, and I have kept pure and unsullied my plighted faith to you." "Not a word of welcome, Louis," she said, as the tears started to her eyes. "Tell me, do tell me that you love me still, and that the joy of seeing me has overcome you and stifled your utterance." Louis Arsenault, with quivering lips and tremulous voice, answered, "Emmeline, speak not so kindly to me, for I am unworthy of you. I can love you no longer. I have pledged my faith to another. Tear from your heart the remembrance of the past and forgive me." And with quick step he walked away and was soon lost to view in the forest. Poor Emmeline stood trembling like an aspen leaf. I took her hand. It was icy cold, and her eye had a vacant stare. "Emmeline, my dear child, be comforted. There may yet be happiness in store for you." "Emmeline, Emmeline," she muttered in an undertone as if to recall that name. "Who is Emmeline?" Then looking in my face, she said in a strange, unnatural voice, "Who are you?" and turned away from me. Her mind was unhinged. This last shock had been too much for her broken heart. She was hopelessly insane. How strange that beings, pure and celestial like Emmeline, should be the sport of fate and be thus exposed to the shafts of adversity. Is it true, then, that the beloved of God are always visited by sore trials? Was it that Emmeline was too ethereal a being for this world, and that God would have her in his sweet paradise? It does not belong to us to solve this mystery and to scrutinize the decrees of providence. We have only to bow submissive to his will. Emmeline never recovered her reason, and a deep melancholy settled upon her. When poor Emmeline strolled upon the banks of the Teche, plucking the wildflowers that strewed her pathway, and singing in soft tones some Acadian song, those that met her wondered why so fair and gentle a being should have been visited with God's wrath. She spoke of Acadia and of Louis in such loving words that no one could listen to her without shedding tears. She fancied herself still the girl of 16 years, on the eve of marrying the chosen one of her heart, whom she loved with such constancy and devotion. Sinking at last under the ravages of her mental disease, she expired in my arms without a struggle and with an angelic smile on her lips. She now sleeps in her quiet grave, shadowed by the tall oak tree near the little church, and her grave has been kept green and flower-strewn as long as your grandmother has been able to visit it. How sad was the fate of poor Emmeline, Evangeline, God's little angel. And burying her face in her hands, grandmother wept and sobbed bitterly. As I have already told you, during 3 years we had lived contented and happy in Maryland, when we received tidings that a number of Acadians, exiles like us, had settled in Louisiana, where they were prospering and retrieving their lost fortunes under the fostering care of the French government. The desire to seek our brother exiles grew keener every day and became so deeply rooted in our minds that we concluded to leave for Louisiana, where the banner of France waved over true French hearts. We announced our determination to our benefactors, the Brent and Smith families, and, undismayed by the perils that awaited us and the obstacles we had to overcome, we prepared for our pilgrimage from Maryland to Louisiana. Our friends used all their eloquence to dissuade us from our resolve, but we resisted all their entreaties, although we were deeply touched by this new proof of their friendship. We disposed of the articles that we could not carry along with us and kept our wagons and horses to transport the women and children and the baggage. In all, we numbered 200 persons, and of these, 50 were well armed and ready to face any danger. We were parting with friends kind and generous, friends who had relieved us in our needs and who had proven true as steel and loving as brothers. And when we grasped their hands in a last farewell, words failed us, and our tears and sobs told them of our gratitude for the benefits they had so generously showered upon us. They too wept, touched to the heart by the eloquent, though mute, expression of our gratitude. Their last words were words of love, glowing with a fervent wish that our cherished hopes might be realized. Our journey was slow and tedious, for 1,000 obstacles impeded our progress. We encountered deep and rapid streams that we could not cross for want of boats. We traveled through mountain defiles, where the pathway was narrow and dangerous, winding over hill and dale and over craggy steeps, where one false step might hurl us down into the yawning chasm below. We suffered from storms and pelting rains, and at night when we halted to rest our weary limbs, we had only the light canvas of our tents to shelter us from the inclemency of the weather. We were undergoing sore trials, but we were lulled by the hope that far, far away in Louisiana, our dreamland, we would find our kith and kin. That radiant hope illumined our pathway, and it stilled our hearts against sufferings and privations almost too great to be borne otherwise. Thus we advanced fearlessly, almost cheerfully, and at night, when we pitched our tents in some solitary spot, our Acadian songs broke the silence and loneliness of the solitude. During days and weeks, we had to march slowly and tediously through endless forests. Thus we toiled on day after day and night after night during 2 long, weary months on our seemingly endless journey until, dispirited and disheartened, our courage failed us. It was a dark hour full of alarming forebodings, and we witnessed the depression of our brother exiles with sorrow and apprehension. But a kind providence watched over us. The hope of finding our lost kindred stimulated our drooping spirits. We had been told that Louisiana was a land of enchantment, where perpetual spring reigned, a land where the soil was extremely fertile, where the climate was so genial and temperate, and the sky so serene and azure as to justly deserve the name of Eden of America. It smiled to us in the distance like the promised land, and toward that land we bent our weary steps. At last we launched on the turbulent waters of the Mississippi and floated down that noble stream as far as Louisiana, where we landed. Once more we were treading French soil, and we were freed from English dominion. As the tidings of our arrival spread abroad, a great number of Acadian exiles flocked to our camp to greet and welcome us. How can I describe our joy and rapture when we recognized countenances familiar to us? Grasping their hands, with hearts too full for utterance, we wept like children. Many a sorrowing heart revived to love and happiness on that day. Many a wife pressed to her bosom a long-lost husband. Many a fond parent clasped in rapturous embrace a loving child. Such a moment repaid us 1,000-fold for all our sufferings and privations, and we spent the day in rejoicing, conviviality, and merriment. You must not imagine that the region was at that time dotted all over like nowadays with thriving farms, elegant houses, and handsome villages. No, it required the nerve and perseverance of your Acadian fathers to settle there. Although beautiful and picturesque, it was a wild region inhabited mostly by Indians and by a few white men, trappers and hunters by occupation. Such was the region your ancestors settled, and which, by their energy, they have transformed into a garden teeming with wealth. The Acadians enriched themselves in a country where no one will starve if he is industrious, and where one may easily become rich if he fears God, and if he is economical and orderly in his affairs. Now I've kept my promise, and my tale is told. Your Acadian fathers were martyrs in a noble cause, and you should always be proud to be the sons of martyrs and of men of principle. Grandmother, we said as we kissed her fondly, your words have fallen in willing and loving hearts, and they will bear fruit. We are proud now of being called Acadians, for there never was any people more noble, more devoted to duty, and more patriotic than the Acadians who became exiles, and who braved death itself rather than renounce their faith, their king, and their country.